دارین؟ بله.
انگلیسی باشه
بگم؟ انگلیسی یا شاید آسون تره و اگر تمام باید.
Oral History Program of Foundation for Iranian Studies, Interview with Professor Richard Fry, Interviewer Vali Reza Nasr, Boston, April 25th, 1989. Professor Fry, let us begin with the theme of Iranian studies, and let me begin by the time you yourself became involved with it.
Well, it's quite a long time ago, before World War II, that I started. I studied Arabic and Persian at Princeton in 1938 and Persian in 1941. So my interest went back quite a number of years.
Was that the only, what were the centers on climate of Iranian studies at that time? Were there numerous places?
No, not at all. Princeton University was the only place where modern Persian, the new Persian language, was taught. Now at Columbia, they did teach Old Avestan and Old Persian, and occasionally modern Persian. But it wasn't a regular feature of teaching. And in other places, they occasionally in departments, or rather courses on linguistics, Old Persian and Avestan would be brought up, but New Persian was not taught regularly anywhere, nor anything really about Iran.
Who did you yourself work with?
Well, for New Persian, it was Mehmed Simsar who was teaching. He actually lived in Philadelphia and came to Princeton to teach. Then also for the ancient field, Olmsted, who was a specialist on Achaemenid history, and several other people who were not specialists in Iranian, but it was mainly Simsar that I started New Persian with.
That time, was there a major interest? I mean, what sort of markets were you looking for? This was purely academic, among your co-students, and or was there air of going to service for government?
No, it was purely academic. There was very little contact with Iran, only missionaries and diplomatic personnel and a few merchants, but usually the merchants were either Iranians, Armenians, or others who knew already Persian. So from the academic point of view, there was very, very little interest and very little knowledge about Iran.
Was there a bias towards what period of history or what aspect of the culture you would study?
Definitely. Before World War II, the only thing about Iran that interested people here in academia was the relation to the Bible. And this meant Achaemenid history and possibly a little bit later, but mostly Achaemenid history. That's Avestan and Old Persia. That was certainly the overwhelming interest of anybody who was interested in Iran.
Mm-hmm. And when you finished, did you begin academic work yourself right away?
No, then the war came along, and I went to Afghanistan, Iran, and Turkey. And after the war, I studied in London with Professor Henning, Walter Henning, Pahlavi and Sogdian, and other old Iranian languages. So that was my real introduction into Iranian studies as opposed to Persian. Of course, I lived for 2.5 years in Kabul, Afghanistan, and there studied
both. Were you a student then?
I was a teacher already. No, I was teaching for Habibia College under the Ministry of Education of the Government of Afghanistan.
And were you in Iran at that time?
Well, I passed through Iran. I really didn't stay. I only came from Herat to Tehran, and then on to Cairo, and then back again. I only stayed a short time in Iran at that time.
Did the war change the climate in the academic environment?
Oh, it certainly did, because, as you know, there were many American soldiers who went to Iran and the Persian Gulf Command sending supplies to Russia, and everything got turned upside down. And in effect, what happened was the United States discovered the whole Orient, for that matter, certainly the Near East after World War II. Before that time, as I said, there were only missionaries and a few other people interested in the area. Afterwards, it was completely changed. You see, the United States, from being an isolationist country, then became a world power and took over Britain's mantle, so to speak.
What was the input of people like yourselves or say the centers of Iranian studies on this new interest in the American government?
Well, not so much on the government. The government here behave very much like governments everywhere. They pay very little attention to academics, unless the academics happen to bless their policies already. Just to give you an example, I had many friends in Russia who were interested in Afghan studies, and they advised the Russian government to not to invade Afghanistan and to because they knew the country and the people. But of course, no one paid any attention to them. The same is true in Washington. They don't pay any attention to academics, as I said, and unless academics favor their policies already made.
What about through students? I mean, did a lot of new students in these programs go into the government and...
Oh, yes. There was
an influence through that channel?
Well, there was some influence, but the real influence started when the Peace Corps was established. Mm-hmm. And, of course, with the tremendous expansion of the use of oil, then Iran, as well as Saudi Arabia and other countries of the Middle East, suddenly became very important economically. And again, people started to go over there. From the academic field, what was interesting, before the war, there, as I said, there were very, very few people interested in Iran, and usually from a kind of antiquarian interest. Afterwards, anthropologists, sociologists, economists, everybody became interested in Iran.
So was this a lopsided interest in Iran, or that these fields themselves, you think, proliferated after the war?
They proliferated themselves after the war, and many people were looking around for fields to go to and countries to go to. Anthropologists saw that there were tribes in Iran, and they wanted to go to study the tribes and the villages. And this is what happened, mainly, that they discovered the country and decided that they would like to investigate.
Did this, in your opinion, what was the impact, say, of Iran on, theoretically on, say, these fields? Was Iran a major, you know, in the same way, say, for instance, Bali was for anthropologists through Clifford Geertz, or did in any way Iran become a major?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Bart, you know, the anthropologist who studied the Basiri, and he set a trend. A lot of people went out. So there were very, very much so people who became interested, especially anthropologists and archaeologists, of course, because Iran was a very fertile field. Very little had been done there, and obviously was important in the past, and also in the present. As I said, in the relation between nomads and settled people, Iran was an ideal place to go.
What was the Iranian government's position? This is, say, before, this is, we're talking about the 50s, and
well,
Iranian studies as such and
political. Yeah. Well, on the whole, under the time up to the fall of Mossadegh, everything was very much open. However, I should mention, just to give you an example of the problems in Iran, I went in 1948 from Shiraz down to Kazerun and then to visit several sites, Sarmashed. And the government in Shiraz told me that I couldn't go because they had absolutely no control over this area. So I had to make contact with the Kashkai, who were, in fact, so to speak, the government of that southern area. And I went with the Kashkai to the places. So there were parts of Iran that were more or less independent of Tehran, at least in their... in the reality, of course, theoretically, they were under Iran of Tehran and paid taxes off and on to them.
But the government looked favorably on this people like yourself working, or were they apprehensive?
Well, they were a little apprehensive because it never happened before that a lot of people were coming into Iran in great numbers. And no, there was a great deal of suspicion and a great deal of problems. Now, one of the problems... I must say that I had to explain many times to not only Americans but other Europeans who came out to Iran, especially to Fars province, to Shiraz, where I was, to advise them. I said to them, now look, you have to get permission. This, when I went with the Kashkai, I had to get to go with the Kashkai. I didn't get government permission. But later you had to have permission to go anywhere and do anything. Now, you, suppose you have a bureaucrat sitting in Tehran, and somebody wants to go and study the Baluch for some reason. Well, he thinks to himself, I have to grant this permission to go. Now, what do I get out of it? Suppose something happens to this person out there. Suppose he's killed by the Baluch or kidnapped. Then I'm to blame. I may lose my job. So why should I give him permission? This was a widespread feeling. Incidentally, it's not just true in Iran. It's true almost everywhere. It's a bureaucratic problem.
Did you fail till the end?
Oh, yes. It's always been that way. And I always advised people coming there, as I said, Europeans as well as Americans, that they must put themselves in the shoes of the person who is supposed to give them permission and to do this, and make sure that nobody gets into trouble if they get into trouble, and to you know, to make sure that nobody is upset with what they're doing. And there are reasons, there are also other reasons. Many times places were not rebellious, but you know, with some bandits in it, and nobody wanted to take responsibility to allow people to go out, especially foreigners.
When did you find Reza Fry, say, interest among Iranian academicians or students in the kind of research you did, say, the emergence of Iranian students interested in Iranian studies or home or such interest within Iranian universities?
Well, there was always an interest there, but it kept on growing in the sense that people, Iranians, became interested in many facets of their own country, which they'd never had before. For instance, anthropology. For instance, archaeologists began to develop. But I must tell you one thing. With the oil boom, with the money pouring into Iran, most people lost their interest in pretty much as in other countries when they're concerned about making money and surviving. Let me explain why. I used to teach here Old Persian and Avestan, and I would only have two or three students. Well, when I went to Shiraz the first time to teach there, in the Persian language, incidentally, and I announced that one of the courses was Old Persian. And the first day of class that I had, over 20 students showed up, and I said, oh my, I'm so glad to be here. Now I'm in a place where people are really interested in this, and they come in numbers. Well, I must tell you, but five or six were from the College of Agriculture, four or five from medicine, and three or four from engineering. And I said, why are you here? And they said, well, we have to take a distribution. And we saw in the catalog, Fursi Qadim, and we said, well, if it's old Persian, I know modern Persian, so this should be an easy snap course for me. And when I explained to them that it was not all that easy, very different and written in cuneiform, why, the next class are only three students from the Department of Persian. So I said, it's just the same as anywhere else. And that was true. I mean, there was a lot of lip service paid to the past of Iran and, of course, pride in the past. But very frankly, there wasn't all that much rushing around. Now, for example, a few years before the revolution, a couple of years, I was sent around the country by the Ministry of Education to Mashhad, Tabriz, Isfahan University, just to do that, to see what the state of the teaching of pre-Islamic subjects were, the ancient history of Iran, the archaeology, Pahlavi, Old Persian, Avestan. And I must say, everywhere that I went, the same story. We don't have any students, and everybody is busy with something else, and they're not interested. I mean, in spite of the fact that people think that under the Shah, there was this tremendous revival of learning about ancient Iran, it's not true. It simply didn't happen.
In comparison, say, with the courses that had to do with the Islamic periods, they were
Certainly, Islamic period were much better off. But there again, all you have to do is look at the figures of students, you know, going into even the Persian language or history of Iran or Iranian studies of one sort. There were very few compared to those going into economics, going into engineering and agriculture, medicine, etc., all these things that were of course more important for a developing country. But this idea that in those years there was a great increase is not really borne out by the facts. Now, there were a number of scholars who developed, certainly, that they didn't have before, especially in Tehran, in the University of Tehran, but under special institutes were set up for the Persian language and for Khanlari's Institute, in which they turned out a number of vocabularies of Pahlavi and Pahlavi text. So there was definitely a small group of people who were very devoted and very well trained, and we did have that. But what I'm saying is that it didn't spread very much. There certainly were a number of excellent scholars.
Let me see. In the sense that there was a general revival in adabiyat, in Persian literature studies. Did this interest in ancient Iran develop within that framework, or was it a
separate field in Europe? No, it was very little. It was really a separate field, because, for instance, in Shiraz, I taught Old Persian, and I taught the ancient history of Iran and dialectology. And I got more students interested in dialectology because they knew that there were these different dialects around, and they'd come from various villages and towns, and they were able to go back and work there and do something that they could really produce something. So there was certainly an interest, but what I'm saying is that this general idea that among the populace and among the large group of students that there was a revival of interest and study of Iranian culture, even Islamic, is not true. I mean, as I said, people were much too busy making money and doing other things.
Culture generally was in a second.
I'm afraid culture took a back seat.
Can you
right?
ask you this, Professor Fry? Since Shiraz itself is close to Takht-e Jamshid and to Pasargad, did you find there was a better awareness of ancient Iran and ancient Iranian studies, say, among the students, or was it the same?
Pretty much the same, because to the university in Shiraz, Pahlavi University, there came students from all over the country, and of course they, by having Persepolis and Pasargadi and Bishapur near at hand, we were able to take students there, and we had expeditions which helped a great deal. I think this certainly had a very positive effect in that regard.
But the very existence of those sites did not have an imprint on the psyche of the Shirazis? You
know? Not very much, not really, no. I mean, it didn't have the same effect, for example, as the monuments of ancient Rome had upon the present-day Romans, who are proud of the fact that they're somehow, and they point them out. There was certainly an attempt to revive, to repair the monuments and the like, and to but people went out to, I tell you frankly, to Persepolis on Friday for picnics, and.
Did the population, say, in large degree towards the end, view ancient Iran with some sort of disdain because it was so much favored by the government?
Of course, there was a little bit. There was a little bit of that, surely. Yeah, very much so. I think.
Do you yourself, as a professor, feel that pressure, say, from students, colleagues, that? You were teaching something that was. A lopsided view of history,
yeah.
Or something like that?
Oh yes, definitely, and especially, you know, with the 2500 celebration at Persepolis and at Pasargadi, a lot of people were rather annoyed about that, and including the students, of course.
Do you
have
any memories of that? Like,
oh, indeed I do. I was very much involved in it, of course, but It was a great extravaganza, but the thing that it was a little too much of an extravaganza, I must say.
Did the objection, was it more to the extravaganza or to the, say, the fact that it put too much emphasis on the ancient part, too much emphasis on Cyrus and Darius?
Well, both. Both, I think. I think the greatest complaint was about the extravagance and the waste and that. Not so much. I mean, Cyrus and Darius, they even among the common people, you know, they had an idea of the glories of the past, and they were not opposed to that. But it was too far away from them. But the students, of course, used this as a kind of club against the government, of course. I mean, they were under the influence of Shariati and other writers and the like, and so they used this, sure.
Mm-hmm. How did they generally react to your presence at the university? Did they see you as an objective, independent researcher, or were you seen as a hand of the American government?
Well, at first, of course, they thought very much so that I was an American spy, even. But after a while, they realized that I was. They became very puzzled because I complained very much myself about the changing of Shiraz. I used to say that they are making it a little Tehran out of it. Tehran should this Dar al Ilm, and I recited to them that became a. Dar al-Ilm became Dar al-Jahiliyyah, and which is true. They really, really, you know, we used to have a very nice, Shiraz, a cultured, lovely little place where we had Sharbat Khanas. Well, they were all changed. They got bars with vodka in them, you know, and people got drunk, and people going around on motorcycles and with gangs, and it should change the whole nature of the place. And I'm sorry to say, but I think the Americans were somewhat responsible for it. I said so, and I used to go to Tehran, you know, and tell the taxi driver, I take a taxi from the airport, and they ask me where I came from. I say, I come from Iran. And they turn around and look at me, what do you mean? I said, well, I came from real Iran. This isn't Iran, Tehran. It certainly wasn't. Tehran had a bad influence on the rest of the country in many respects, and it was felt and resented by many Shirazis. I remember the first festival of arts that we had in Shiraz. I was on
the Shiraz Art Festival.
I was on the board, you know, for 2 years till they threw me off, because I said to the people there, the Tehranis who came down to organize, I said, why don't we bring in people from neighboring countries, Afghanistan, Turkey, even Soviet Union, Tajikistan, dances, music and the like, for this festival. And they looked at me and say, Mr. Fry, they say, we are avant-gardists, we are not folklorists. We want the most advanced, shocking thing we can perform, and that's what they did. And frankly, I remember I had my wallet stolen the first year it was down there. I went to the police, the Shirazi police. We can't do anything. These Tehranis come down, and we've lost control of everything.
But was the anger turned towards the government or merely the Tehran culture?
Well, both. Toward the government. Now, I remember once when I went to Qom, the last year, but just before Ayatollah Burujerdi died, I went to see him. And then when I came back, I was going with a friend of mine, and we stopped in a southern Tehran place where the Imam Jumeirah and everybody, a whole bunch of Ayatollahs and Mullahs were there. And I remember one of them getting up, and I'll never forget this. He said in public, you know, what we should do is slit the throats of all people living north of Takht-i Jamshid in this city. So there was definitely what happened in Iran. The Tehran Shimran crowd became so separated from the rest of the country, they didn't even know what was going on. The only thing that interested them were the latest fashions from Paris and what was going on in London and Washington, not what was going on in Zabul or Mashhad or Kazerun or places like that.
Let me ask you, aside from this sort of political resentment, did the art festival have any artistic impact on Shiraz? You know, what was part of its original mission of having an artistic impact on Iran, on art, culture, development. What was the test?
This is absolute. I tell you, it was unbelievable. They came down and they, as I said, they wanted to get the most outlandish, the most far out productions of the left bank of Paris, of the Ginza of Tokyo, or lower Manhattan. Things that would shock New Yorkers and Parisians and bring them to Shiraz. Well, for example, they brought Stockhausen, who is the German maestro of this modern music, which is not music, but loud sounds, tremendous, you know, great loud sounds. And he put up his loudspeakers in Sarai Mushir and the bazaar in Shiraz. And he, this is late at night, you know, people asleep, they have to go to work in the morning. And blasting this, and we try, you know, they tried to tell him to keep out of Shiraz, go out to Persepolis, put your music out there. No, it's got to be right in the city so it has an effect on people. It sure did. They were ready to tear the place apart. The things that went on in Shiraz were, of course it had no effect. The people became very upset. And then toward the end, just before the revolution, you know, the government in Tehran finally realized what was going on, and they decided they'd better change, so they put on some taziyas. But they were, again, a little bit artificial, I must say.
They didn't, things like that, or say the Molevi dances from Turkey or Qawwali, they didn't have imprint on...
But that's what they didn't do. They brought, as I said, the most productions from Shiraz, from Tokyo, or from Paris, but particularly Paris and London and New York. Mm-hmm. Or Berlin.
Were you in Shiraz? Were you in contact with the religious establishment there?
Yeah, sure, off and on.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any reminiscences?
Oh yeah, I used to. I used to go every frequently on Thursday evenings to the Haksari Hanagah, mm-hmm. And then I met people. Even that time, where you'd have Ayatollahs coming to Hanagahs and things were...
reminiscence of any particular
one? Well, I can't really... I knew... I met all of the... my God, my memory is fading now. Some of the top people of the Imam Jumu'ah, you know, of Shiraz. But, I mean, I really didn't have anything, you know, much to do with them. I saw them, talked to them, and we had... interesting little talks off and on, but nothing, you know, nothing.
What was your attitude about the university as a whole and say studies like your own?
You mean on the part of them? That's hard to say, because many of them had sons and daughters studying at the university, or in America, or in England, you know, or France. So, I remember, just to give an example, I had my son was over there, and he rammed into a mujtahid who was driving the car, and of course the police took us to the court, and we were very polite to each other, and the police were tremendously amused. They said, "Oh my God," they said, "here is a professor at the university and a mullah. How can we do anything?" So, and I talked a lot he was a real mujtahid, all right, he was very nice, you know. I mean, I got along all right, well with them, and everything was quite relaxed until it got worse and worse somehow. I got very much more tense. And
Professor, did the rest of, say, this evolving American establishment of Iranian studies share your views, or what did they have possess a different philosophy?
No, not on the whole, although I would guess that most of them... You see, I worked for the Iranian government. I didn't work...
But I'm saying generally, the empathic attitude you have for Iranian culture and the hands-on attitude you had of being in place, experiencing it firsthand, having empathy for the local culture.
Yeah.
was this the dominant attitude?
No, not dominant. There, of course, there were others that felt very much as I did. But, of course, everybody considered me a little bit queer, you know, working for the Iranian government, being in Iran and being Iranian more than American. Because a lot of them came out there just to use it as a field for study, put their model in. They could have just as well gone to Indonesia or to Paraguay or whatever. They came to Iran instead because they had
a
fellowship.
Did they get sufficiently acquainted with Persian language and culture in the sense that Iran sort of leaves an imprint on them?
I would say the people who got the best imprint were in the Peace Corps. These people, you know, because they really worked with the people and they were out. Many of the others came to Tehran and became part of the embassy and Morris Knudsen and Bell Helicopter people. I had very little to do, I had nothing to do with them except when I happened to meet them in the airport and listen to their stories, which were, I think the Americans, after the Vietnam War, you know, many of them came to Iran. They were more or less soldiers of fortune, and just to make money, and to, you know, have a good time. And I must say also at the university, Padley, it was, I got very annoyed, and I told the different heads of the university they were making a bad mistake. They would bring people, you know, we want Nobel Prize winners from University of Pennsylvania in physics. But what's a Nobel Prize going to do in this college, you know, what's he going to teach? And of course they got some first-rate professors at enormous salaries. But they taught one course with their left hand and they went touring in the country, more or less. I mean, they contributed nothing. And then they went away. They had no stake, or they had no real interest in Iran. I mean, there were a lot of people like that, unfortunately.
Well, did Iranian studies in the 70s have any impact on U.S. policy towards Iran? I doubt it very much.
Well, maybe some of the political scientists did. I would say that people like Dick Cottom, for example, a former student of ours, who was in the State Department and resigned because of his belief that the policies were wrong after Mossadegh, they were certainly not well regarded by the State Department or by the government, but there were others like Donald Wilbur, who worked for the government actually, and George Lenkowski and others who were very much, I guess, listened to. I really don't know just what their influence was. My problem was I kept away from the American government and most Americans most of the time.
So in other words, there were two different currents
definitely.
In Iranian studies.
Oh yes, definitely. Yeah, there were those who were, and I must say that in my opinion, those who were most appreciative and who really were touched by Iranian culture were mainly those people who worked outside of Tehran and who, like the Peace Corps, like anthropologists who really became interested in the country, or people who were interested in helping the country found it very attractive. But unfortunately, I don't think they were in the majority by any means.
Let me ask you, what year did you go to Shiraz, Professor Fry?
Well, you mean to start teaching? Well, that was in 1969 when I went there, yeah, for the long period. Then I was the director of the Asia Institute of the university
How
for
do
5 years.
How did you find the general, say, climate of relations with students and professors and... was it already political at that point?
Oh yeah, the politicization of the students had gone apace, and even somewhat in the faculty. But in our field, that is in Iranian studies, in art and archaeology, and languages and history, we sort of kept away from that. I mean, I really didn't have much to do with the political feelings at all, and. There was no reason to, and I felt that I shouldn't. It was not my business, really.
Let me ask you this. During the last decade of the Pahlavi regime, under the Queen's Bureau, there was a lot of interest in museums and rejuvenating interest in that aspect of culture. Do you have an assessment of that?
Oh yes, I was very much involved in that, and I think this was something that in the long run, even now and in the future, will have an impact, because they still exist, and I'm sure that they will be revived again in the future. And I think people, even in Shiraz, when people were helping to restore, even the workers, they had a feeling of doing something for that. When we employed people to restore the Naranjistan and helped out in other restorations, and I think it was a very good thing. I remember once going on a trip up in Azerbaijan, way up toward the Turkish and Soviet border, and visiting an Armenian church, and there was a Frenchman there who was having a terrible time because his interpreter had to go to Tabriz, and he was complaining that the workers weren't working. So I had to go and talk to the workers. They were Kurds, and they said, well, why should we work on this Armenian church, this is a terrible, what are we doing? And I had to give them a lecture and saying this is one of the it doesn't matter that it's not Islamic or anything, it's got to be, it's one of the treasures of the Iranian past, and it's your duty, and so on. And they listened, and I think I got through to them, because they went back to work. But I mean, I think little by little there was some sinking in, of the importance of preserving whatever the past had. I mean, you might not like some of it, but still the feeling that that everybody has got the past, and it's necessary to have the memory and to preserve it.
Professor Fry, what do you think has come of Iranian studies since the revolution, particularly your own areas?
Well, it's rather strange, because on the one hand, while there has been obviously a decline in the sense that the government is not interested in it, even trying to change Nowruz and the like, yet the number of students has increased dramatically. I should say, my friend Dr. Ahmed Tafazuli, who teaches Pahlavi at the University of Tehran, well, before the revolution, he'd have 4 or 5 students, not more. Now he's got 50 or 60 in the classes. Well, you know what it is. It's a reaction against the present regime, and that's I think there is a very great reaction. Editions of Firdowsi are being sold in Tehran. Of course, you can't get paper anymore, but all of them, and so there's a great interest in the past. That's a kind of reaction against the Arabization and over Islamization of Iran.
But it sort of has not sort of extinguished that aspect of...
No, it can't. I mean, whatever they try, they can't get rid of Nowruz. They can't get rid of the past. I think it's absurd to try to do so. But I gather they have tried.
What has been the effect on Iranian studies outside?
Terrible. A decimation. I mean, there's been a complete collapse of Iranian studies outside. I mean, in this country, of course, what happened, which was bad in a way, that every university and every, not only universities, museums, everybody, depended on money from Iran to support Iranian studies. So along came the revolution, the money stopped. Then all their institutions and their programs went stopped. And so students couldn't go to Iran, so nobody's studying Persian, nobody's studying Iran. Oh, we've had disaster. I mean, everywhere, many places, they've closed down centers of Iranian studies. Portland State no longer has, used to have a flourishing department with 3 or 4 people, teaching. Now no one. And this, all over the country, this is the case, yeah.
Now you mentioned this money that used to come from Iran for Iranian studies. Did the Iranian government, was there any values attached to any project, any objective attached to the money that was given, or just Iranian?
Well,
what effect it had on the politics of Iranian studies, on the kind of research that was done and not done?
Oh, I think there was kind of directed research, but nothing forceful, The Pahlavi Library in Tehran with old Shujahdin Shafa got interested in Mithraism. I introduced him to a man called John Hinnells, and so he gave them of money for Mithraic conferences on Mithraism. Well, Mithraism hasn't got all that much to do with Iran, but they, things like that did happen. So there was, I think it was a little bit unfortunate that it became so identified, you know, that the Iranian studies became identified with the largesse, the money coming from Iran, so that when it stopped too.
You also brought, this brings up another interesting question, I think, of how does Iran, or how did and how does Iranian studies fare against other area studies?
Well, now they're in very bad shape.
Not only comparatively, but as far as crossing territories. I mean, some obvious cases are these debates over Persian Gulf and Arabian Gulf. But even in a more basic way as to who wields more influence in American academia.
American academia, the Arab-Israeli dispute overshadows everything. All of the entire area is dominated by Arab-Israeli problems, yeah.
But that even overshadows, you think, this romantic view of Iranian...
I'm afraid so. It's just, as I said, overwhelming, such that in every department that you look at, Iranian studies is at the very bottom of the totem pole. Well, some cases Turkish is in bad shape, but even Turkish, and generally speaking, is better off, Turkic studies. But Arab-Israeli dominate the whole thing, yeah.
And this is combines with the who pays money.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, the money comes in from Jewish and Arab sources, no question about it. And that's the influence politically, too. Iran has no political clout. It's negative. I mean, as you know, the enemy number one, I gather, for all the Americans and Europeans.
Is there a correlation between crisis and then American funding of
Oh, yes, absolutely. There's no question about it. I mean,
that doesn't happen. Say, instead of the Iranian money that's no longer coming because this country is so central that the U.S. would, U.S. foundations would.
No, just the opposite. Quite the contrary. What U.S. foundations and the government say. Since nobody can go there, since we're boycotting, since we're isolating Iran, let's continue. They've simply written it off. That's the problem. No, you would think so. I mean, you would think that now that they haven't got this connection, that they want to learn more about it.
The whole argument constantly after the revolution was that we didn't know enough about Iran. That the natural conclusion would be that, particularly at times of crisis, there would be more funding for increasing knowledge.
Well, this would work if we were had relations with Iran in any way. But I'm afraid what has happened is there's a complete cut-off, boycott, isolation, whatever you want to call it, as far as the government is concerned. And I'm afraid that's a kind of normal reaction that you'd get from people who emotional Washingtonians. Of course, they're very upset with what's going on in Iran, but you're quite right, they certainly don't know, but they didn't know before either. Everybody in the country and the countryside knew there was a revolution coming, except the American embassy, apparently.
Mm.